Peace. We're very pleased to have you this morning at this event entitled Engaging Moderate Islamist Democratic Promise or Political Peril. Mona, it's a great title, very evocative, and in fact very accurate for what we are doing and what we are discussing this morning. I want to frame this morning's panel for just a minute and give you a sense of the bigger picture in terms of what this panel is about and how it relates to our programs at USIP. We started some 2 years ago, embarked upon a major project looking at political oppositions in the Middle East and the Arab world in particular. And one of the focuses of this project was an inquiry into the capacity of interest groups, political parties, NGOs, and so on, representing both Islamists and secularists, to forge political pacts and alliances in ways that would perhaps push the political agenda project forward. This project, it should be said, has been funded generously by USAID, and we have our colleague Josh Kaufman from USAID here this morning that has been partners in this project all along. The first part of the project was the commissioning of four studies of interest groups and Islamist secular relations, to put it in a nutshell, in Jordan, Egypt, Yemen, and Morocco. These case studies are almost finished, and we look forward to publishing them. And more than just case studies, each of these is in effect a short book, and we're looking forward to publishing them here at the United States Institute of Peace this year. In conjunction with these four studies of interest groups and alliance making in the Middle East, we held a conference in Rabat in late May of this year, in which we brought Islamists and secularists around the table to, in effect, interrogate these reports and those who had written them, and to use the occasion to talk about the wider issue of democratic reform, alliances within the region, but also alliances, in effect, or lack thereof in some cases, between the United States, democracy promoters, and their allies on the ground. So it was a very comprehensive conference, a very interesting one, an off-the-record conference for purposes of allowing everybody to speak their minds, but we are integrating many of the ideas that are raised in the conference into the final report that will be produced in conjunction with this project. We are also going to hold next week in Berlin a conference on European and American approaches to engaging Islamists. We are doing so with our colleagues at the German Institute of International Relations and Security Studies, and that is just part and parcel of the kinds of activities we are pursuing. Beyond that, we are organizing a task force on the issue of security and political reform in the Middle East. You'll hear more about that in the coming weeks, and we have a number of other activities. So we have a rather full plate in terms of the particular programs that I help to manage at USIP. I also should add that other programs, including the Religion and Peacemaking Program, is very active, and they are sending a delegation to Iran in a few days to sit down with clerics and intellectuals and talk about issues of political reform. Obviously, it's an especially interesting time to send a delegation of Americans to Iran to talk about these issues. So we have a lot going on. And in that context, I would want to emphasize that Mona's report that we're going to discuss today is also part and parcel of this USAID-funded project on political reform and interest groups in the Middle East. Mona has produced an extremely interesting manuscript that looks at the efforts of democracy promoters from the United States government and others, but particularly from NDI and IRIA, to work with moderate Islamist parties on the ground in the Middle East. And this is an initial, and we have to stress, an initial assessment of this very interesting endeavor, which points to the fact that, in fact, the engagement of Islamists is an ongoing process. It's not something that is new. It's often treated as something that is new, or there are people writing on this issue in the policy community who are often promoting the idea of engagement as if it hasn't happened, but in fact it's been ongoing for quite a while. And it's not just Turkey or Egypt or Turkey or Iraq where we find engagement of Islamists. We find the U.S. government as well as democracy promoters working with Islamists throughout the region. In this sense, Egypt is an interesting and somewhat complex exception. So we're here today to discuss Mona's report. The report is outside. Plus, there are, it's very much a mono-Yacoubian morning, because all, I think all your reports for USIP, Mona, are outside, so we encourage our audience to help themselves. We'll also be doing a mailing of the reports. It hasn't gone out yesterday. It's going out today. Commenting on the report is a distinguished panel of people drawn from the democracy promotion community. They are all good friends and colleagues of ours. Les Campbell from the National Democratic Institute, Tom Garrett from the IRI, and of course I mentioned Josh Kaufman, our partner in this whole project. So I'm going to ask Mona to provide an outline of the main conclusions of her report, and then we'll start for some observations from our colleagues, starting with Les. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for coming. Dan, thank you for your kind introduction. I also want to thank my colleagues from AID, IRI, and NDI for their tremendous help and support throughout the research and writing of this paper. They provided me with invaluable access to their staffs and other things, and so I thank you all very much for that. Let me begin by saying, as Dan noted, the very fact of that engagement with moderate Islamists has been going on now for maybe a decade, I think is in and of itself noteworthy and important, just standing on its own. Again, I think my paper looks very specifically at three cases, Morocco, Jordan, and Yemen, and I look very much at the work of NDI and IRI in engaging with those parties on the ground there. The study considered several key questions, but the most important is really to look at how Islamist parties have responded over time to U.S. efforts to engage in democracy promotion activities. And really, the key questions come down to, have, in effect, U.S. efforts to engage these parties helped to moderate their politics, agendas, and political actions? To what extent have U.S. efforts strengthened or reinforced moderate forces within Islamist parties and movements? Or have Islamists exploited U.S.-funded training to promote anti-democratic agendas? Now, before answering the question, I think it's essential to acknowledge the inherent difficulties in trying to measure moderation. And how does one do that? I think really three obstacles are apparent. First, it is difficult, if not impossible, to quantify or empirically measure or document a movement toward moderation. Secondly, to the extent that one can document shifts in a party's position, is this simply pragmatic politics, tactical maneuvers, or is it evidence of a genuine shift in worldview? And thirdly, if these normative shifts have indeed taken place, to what extent can they be ascribed directly to U.S. engagement in activities with these parties? So let me, truth in advertising, there's some clear difficulties from the get-go. Given these difficulties, I chose to focus on some concrete indicators, is what I would call them, that would help gauge key changes in Islamist parties' outlook and worldview. And I specifically outline four indicators. The first is the content of party platforms as well as public statements and other public documents. The second is the degree of internal democracy and transparency within the structures of these political parties. The third is, to the extent that parties may have members serving in parliament, what has the role of these parties been in parliament? What types of legislation have they promoted? How actively engaged have they been in the democratic process such as it exists in any of the countries that we are talking about? And finally, what has been the party's willingness to cooperate with secular counterparts, particularly with regard to moving reform-related issues forward? So let me get right to it and first give you my key bottom-line conclusion. And that is that, taking into account the caveats that I've mentioned to you and using the indicators that I outlined, my research suggests that, by and large, U.S. engagement with Islamist parties has had a positive effect on their evolution toward moderation and on their development as democratic actors. I will give you some greater specifics with regard to each of the cases that I looked at in a moment, but I think essentially, to varying degrees, Islamist parties in Morocco, Yemen, and Jordan showed positive movement in at least some of these indicators, if not all of them. Now, some did better in some areas than others, and I think overall one has to be somewhat modest about the level of success. But nonetheless, I estimate that results were promising enough to suggest that U.S. engagement with Islamist parties should not only be continued, but should actually be deepened in the quest to promote sustained political opening and democratic transformation in the Arab world. Let me turn briefly to some of the specific conclusions. First, Morocco. I think of the three cases that I considered, Morocco appears to hold the greatest promise for U.S. engagement with moderate Islamists. Now, I'm going to stick to this conclusion despite the parliamentary elections that took place earlier this month. I'm not going to go into too much detail. Les may want to describe that a little bit more in his remarks. Essentially, the Party of Justice and Development, known as the PJD, the primary legal Islamist party in Morocco, was slated to win perhaps a plurality in that election. Had they done that, I think we would have been having a very different and perhaps even more interesting discussion this morning. Instead, the vote was marred by very low voter turnout, only 37%, and the PJD came in second. They still had a respectable showing, and I think it's still important to talk a bit about how their role in Morocco's political scene, but I do think it's important to also note that Morocco's relatively low voter turnout points to deeper problems with Morocco's political reform problems that need to be addressed. This isn't the forum to do that, but I do want to go on record as suggesting that there's still quite a lot of work to be done in Morocco. Nonetheless, the PJD did gain seats in the election. They went from 42 to either 46 or 47. There's some uncertainty about that count. And they remain the most powerful opposition force in Morocco. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. They're setting their sights clearly on municipal elections that are scheduled for 2009, where they will seek to gain greater control of local municipalities. So over the period of its engagement with U.S. party institutes, I noted that the PJD has demonstrated a greater evolution toward moderation. And this is evident in several ways, certainly in terms of their platform, in particular the way in which they treat the role of Sharia law. It's evident in their high degree of internal transparency and democracy. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that of all the political parties in Morocco, the PJD is perhaps the most democratic with respect to how it operates internally. And it's also evident in the terms of the party's role in parliament, its activism on key issues, largely dealing with governance and accountability and corruption. They really did not put their sort of moral agenda issues front and center. Indeed, I would say that the PJD's experiences may well represent the Arab world's most important test case for the inclusion of moderate Islamists in the political system. And the party has clearly played a key role in Morocco's nascent political opening. Let me now turn to Yemen. While Morocco clearly stands out as the most promising example, I do think that both Yemen and Jordan offer limited but important instances of success. In Yemen, I would underscore NDI's role of fostering a unique Islamist secular coalition for reform. It's really quite laudable and impressive. There, the Islamist party, the Islah party, got together with a coalition of six other parties, most notably this Yemeni Socialist Party, and together put forward a very impressive agenda for reform. They also agreed on a presidential candidate who did not win the elections, but nonetheless fared relatively well. Here I think Yemen is, again, a case to be emulated by others. Many believe that these kinds of Islamist secular alliances are critical for engendering moderation and pressuring recalcitrant regimes to reform. Finally, in Jordan, here I think the impact of U.S. engagement is far less notable, and we can talk about that more in the discussion if people are interested. Primarily, I would say, it's because the Islamic Action Front, the primary Islamist opposition party in Jordan, has instituted a boycott against all U.S. organizations. So obviously, this greatly restrains the capacity of groups like NDI and IRI to work with the party. As a result, most efforts to engage Islamists have focused on a new and relatively minor Islamist party, Al-Wasat, which represents the sort of centrist Islamist movement that we are seeing emerge throughout the Arab world, known as the Wasatiyah movement. While these efforts are commendable, I think that Al-Wasat's relatively recent arrival on the political scene, coupled with the fairly tenuous quality of Jordan's political opening, suggests slow progress at best in Jordan. Nonetheless, I do think U.S. efforts to help strengthen Al-Wasat may pay off in the long term. It'll be interesting to look at the upcoming parliamentary elections. I believe they're scheduled for November in Jordan, and see whether or not the Al-Wasat party is able to gain some seats in the parliament. I'd like to conclude with three sort of broad brush conclusions, assessments that I've came across. One is that across the board, U.S. efforts to engage moderate Islamists resulted in the development of strong working relationships that were characterized by a high degree of professionalism. Regular contact between American democracy promoters and Islamist party partners, sometimes as frequently as biweekly, was a feature in all of the cases. Islamist parties demonstrated great enthusiasm and interest in participating in a number of programs, and a strong reservoir of trust was developed. Even during boycotts and areas of high tension between the United States and the Arab world, dialogue continued in most cases. And I think that this element of diplomacy that is a feature of all the relationships is an important one that has accompanied U.S. efforts to engage Islamists. Secondly, given the strategic importance that has been assigned to U.S. efforts to promote democracy in the Arab world, it is essential to consider the role of Islamist parties. These parties have proven time and again their popular strength and their ability to do well in free elections. They have also shown a capacity to evolve toward greater moderation. Now, while this evolution deserves continued and close scrutiny, fears of an Iranian-style revolution with Islamist parties running amok, I think, are exaggerated. There are powerful arguments for their continued inclusion in the region's fragile political openings. Political participation appears to be exerting a moderating influence, and it therefore follows that U.S. democracy promotion should encourage and entail greater engagement of these critical actors. And then finally, I think it's important to view U.S. engagement of moderate Islamists within a broader political context. The Arab world, indeed really the entire Muslim world, is in the throes of an ideological battle for what the role of Islam in public life should be. The threat of Islamist extremism has pervaded each of the three countries that I examined to varying degrees. And in all of them, moderate Islamist parties who reject violence and practice democratic ideals serve as a critical counterweight to extremism. These parties could play a critical role in helping to develop an indigenous, forward-looking counter-ideology that would bring the Arab world into the 21st century, albeit on its own terms. Engaging these forces, I would argue, therefore, is essential to understanding and influencing the broader ideological struggle. And I will conclude with that.
Thanks very much, Mona. There's much to discuss in your very interesting summary of your paper, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Les for some comments on Mona's paper. Thanks.
Should we stay sitting, or does it matter?
It's up to you.
I'll stay
We're not going to impose the podium.
Okay.
You're a little too tall.
Thanks. Good morning, and I just want to say thanks to Dan, Mona, Josh, for allowing me to be here, but also for making this paper possible. It's actually very rare occasion that the work of NDI and IRI gets examined this way. And it was a pleasure, I have to say, to have someone like Mona call and say, we'd like to look at your reports and delve into them. I remember digging up a stack of paper, something like this, and saying, have at it, you know, quarterly reports from years back. And she did a number of phone interviews and in-person interviews with NDI staffers. And it was a fairly rare occasion for people to sit back and think a little bit about what they did and why they did it and what kind of effect it had. So it's great to have this paper. And as it turns out, we've invited Mona to come and address the NDI board meeting tonight, where we will talk about the same subject, because, again, it's rare to actually have a paper to look at NDI's work and give us a chance to discuss it internally. Maybe just before I get going on the paper, I'll mention Morocco, because I just returned from Morocco last week, where I was part of an NDI-organized international election observation delegation. First time that Morocco has invited international observers, and NDI was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time and to be able to sort of procure an official invitation for this. We put together a group of 52 people. We based a lot of their work on the work of our office and our staff over the years. We normally would not have done this with such short notice if we didn't feel confident that we knew the context and the background. I'll just very quickly give my read on this. First thing is that the PJD, right up until election night, was very confidently predicting between 70 and 80 seats. In fact, their leadership was suggesting 80 right up until the eve of the election. So the results were quite a surprise to the PJD. The second thing that I think is worth mentioning, two things. One is that the low turnout figure and the previous turnout figures given from 2002 and 1997, even 1993, are all quoted as if they are absolutely the case. So in other words, people are using the sort of declared turnout figures from 2002, 1997, as if we all know what they really were. We know that this one was 37% because we were there and there was absolute transparency in the counting of the votes, and the observers, the party observers, the domestic observers, watched, wrote down, and then the party observers were given official signed copies of the protocols in every polling station. So we know that 37% is accurate this time. We have no idea if the claimed turnout figure from 2002 was accurate, and my suggestion, or from 1997 or earlier elections, my suggestion, looking at what happened in Egypt when the Egyptians had to throw the doors open a little bit to domestic observers, and official turnout figures plummeted from the 80 percentage range to the 20 some odd percent, my suggestion is that Morocco is the same thing. It's not as dramatic, because I think that probably in 2002 they came up with a figure that sounded plausible, which was, I don't know what it was, 54% or something. So I'm not sure that the turnout was that much worse this time. I mean, this is purely conjecture, but I think people shouldn't quote the earlier figures like they're absolutely true, although the 37% is true. The second thing, the election, in my opinion, turned out to be much more interesting than anticipated, because the 19% figure for spoiled or non-valid ballots is huge. I mean, for any of you that have looked at elections, you'll know that even in developing countries, a more normal figure would be in the 5, 6, 7% range, and that would be fairly high. In a developed country, it's much, much lower, 2, 1, 2%, 3%. Having received all the reports from our delegations, 52 people, but it's still a reasonable coverage, everybody, with the exception of one team, agreed that the majority of the spoiled ballots were purposeful. They were slashed out, they were X'd out, they had things written all over them. People sometimes X'd out every single party, probably took them 5 minutes to X them all out. So it was we were estimating, again, this, we can't prove it, although we'll try to do a little bit of research. We received a woman's PhD thesis from the 1993 election, and she did have access to some of these figures. We're going to try to research this a bit, but we think that as many as 80% of the non-counted or the non-counting ballots were intentionally spoiled. So if that many people go out and intentionally spoil a ballot, they're sending a very strong message, and I think they're sending a message to the king and to the entire political establishment. So we all ended up being quite excited about the election. It is not apathy. People also stayed home. So between staying home, spoiling the ballots, and voting PJD, I think Moroccans very actively sent a message. But unfortunately, it's not a talk about Morocco, so I'll leave it there. Just to address the paper more directly, I've just broken this into really three sections, kind of following Mona's paper. One is the question of moderation and intent. And this is always going to be controversial, and I shared with Mona when I came in a letter that we received from the PJD last night in reaction to Mona's paper, where the PJD appears upset at NDI that we expressed our intent to support moderates within the party. And I think the reason that they're upset about that is that this idea of, you know, moderate Islamism versus not moderate and who might be moderate and what that means and so on is very controversial. And I think that they don't like seeing this in black and white on a piece of paper, and we understand that. And it's impossible within any political party to determine intent, either of the individuals or of the party as a whole. And in discussing this with colleagues at NDI yesterday, we were saying, you know, what's the intent of any political party? You take the Democratic Party in the United States, you can easily find leaders within the party with entirely different intentions and entirely different intents on any given issue or set of issues. But I would argue that in the case of the three parties mentioned, but particularly PJD and ISLA in Yemen, the issue, I don't think we have to worry too much about the intent or individuals' intent or the party's intent. I think there is observed moderation in behavior over the period of time that Mona looked at and that NDI and IRI have been engaged. And there's just no question about that. I don't have time to go into that. Mona talked about a number of the things. We had noticed a couple of years ago, for example, that the PJD put forward what we would perceive or what we would describe as moderates for committee leadership positions within the Moroccan parliament. And when they had hardliners in those positions, they found ways of getting them out. They wanted the moderates put forward. So there has been an observed moderation. And I would argue that whether or not it's their intent or whose intent doesn't matter that much. But if they behave pragmatically, they feel that they have to behave a certain way to get certain rewards. They appreciate in some way the relationship with outside groups like NDI and IRI, although it's always a little bit prickly. All those kind of incentives add up and it causes some change in behavior. Intent is very difficult to tell. The second thing that we've noticed, again, mostly in Yemen and in Morocco, but also in Jordan, is that the seeming success of the Islamist parties, they're quite radically better internal organization, their tendency to be more internally democratic, their tendency to be much more organized as parliamentary groups and much more effective as parliamentary groups, rubs off on other parties. One could argue that in Morocco, the constant international credit to the PJD about being the best organized and most internally democratic, combined with quite a scare from an IRI poll, whether that was, you know, exactly accurately reported on or not, Tom might mention, but that got the other parties geared up to do a better job, and they sort of cleaned up their act to some extent because of that. So that's kind of an unintended effect of these programs, but it is a good effect. Just the third quick comment on causality. Again, we were discussing this internally yesterday, and we talk about it a lot. What role did NDI play in the success stories that Mona talked about? Well, of course, it's hard to draw direct lines and direct causal comparisons, but an analogy that we were using recently is the analogy of the surfboard in the water. I think we had something to do with waxing and maybe shaping the surfboard, and we had something to do with placing it in the right spot, waiting for the wave. But when the wave came, the wave being the desire of Islamist parties in the cases that Mona mentions to participate lawfully and peacefully in a process, the fact that we were there very, you know, quite consistently and over a long period of time, that we had something to offer, that we had something of value to them, had an impact, and they were able to take advantage of that. As a colleague at NDI said yesterday, the causality in the surfing analogy is somewhat, it's somewhat less passive than a surfer just standing in the water waiting for the wave. It's obviously somewhat more passive, I should say, than that, but it's much less passive than the moon causing surges in the ocean. It's somewhere in between. It's very difficult to draw those parallels, but we were there. And finally, on Jordan, I agree that the case is not as clear. The IAF is a whole different sort of kettle of fish, and so on. But I would also remind people that there was never a serious democracy program in Jordan, USAID funded or U.S. government funded in Jordan, until maybe 2 or 3 years ago. There were democracy programs there, but they had nothing to do with political parties. And NDI received its first USAID grant in Jordan, I think, less than 2 years ago. So unlike the history in Morocco and Yemen, which goes way back, in Yemen to 1993, Morocco in 1997, the history in Jordan is very recent. So I would argue that it's probably too early to tell. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So I would like to thank the Institute and Mona for this report. We found it a real pleasure to work with her, and we especially appreciated the very thorough nature of what she did in her interviews with staff and spending time with us, actually listening to us. And so once again, thank you. I think it's a very valuable report. One of the areas of the report that I think is probably of the most use is the idea of looking at the impact official U.S. policy has on what it is that institutes, groups, democracy promoters like ours is doing in these countries. I think we've all probably seen the headlines, or we've all heard the reports of boycotts or official suspensions of work by these Islamic parties with U.S. democracy promoters. But as Mona reports, and I think it's something people hear probably don't hear as often unless they hear directly from IRI or NDI, there's never really that complete severance of relationship between our groups and these political parties. We're able to continue to keep these lines of communication open, and I think that's something that over time, the fact that the party institutes have remained engaged with the Islamic parties that were the focus of this report, I think that has gone a long ways towards trying to build relationships that are going to make a difference in the long term. As far as other aspects of the report, Mona points out that these Islamic parties are vehicles for popular opposition, and I think that's very clear from what we've seen in IRI polling in the countries of Morocco and Jordan leading up to elections. And I think it's very interesting to see that in Jordan's recent municipal elections, and then also in these Moroccan parliamentary elections recently, the parties didn't do quite as well as they expected. And I think you can see that probably in the case of PJD in Morocco, they were banking really on this popular sentiment that they could sense that was out there. You don't really see any aspect of a voter turnout program. You don't see the nuts and bolts of what political parties are supposed to do to ensure that, whether it's a low turnout or not, their voters make it to the polling place on election day. And I think it's the same way in Jordan with the IAF. If you look at the platform they were presenting to people, it's true, they were probably the chief critics denouncing government malpractice, government corruption. But they said very little to people about their economic policies, which I think sets them very clearly distinct from a party such as the AK Party, which many of these are often compared to in Turkey, which I think is known very strongly for its economic policy platforms. One of the things I do believe also, let me just say, out of these Jordanian and Moroccan elections that I think we're very hopeful about, is that I think this should have removed some of the fear that policymakers have at times at the idea that elections are going to produce an Islamic tidal wave of some sort out there that would be negative for us. Another aspect of the report I did want to just briefly touch upon is this idea of our work moderating Islamic parties. We don't certainly have that as any type of a goal. As a matter of fact, I think when we first started interacting with parties in Morocco and Jordan, that was a fear that they had, is that our purpose in being there was to actually try to alter their behavior or their belief system in some way. The way we approach the work that we're doing in these places is really just a very neutral transfer of information, technology on campaign, technology on organization. It's things that could be used by any of the political parties in that system, be they Islamist, secular. And these are some of the ways that I think we have over time been able to build these relationships so that they don't see us purely as a tool or an arm of U.S. policy, but they see us as someone that's there attempting to work to make them better representatives of their voters, as opposed to trying to make some big, significant social change. Let me just mention briefly on public opinion research that we have done in Jordan, because we still have this test coming of the Jordanian parliamentary elections in November. Over time, over the last few years, we have seen a steady decrease in IRI poll data in Jordan for those voters who say they would probably support an Islamic tendency in voting. And we've seen a corresponding increase in those people who say they would vote for a political party that had a Jordanian nationalist tendency. Having said that, I should say that the numbers who say they would vote for any party at all are below 10%. So we're looking at still an extremely weak political party system in Jordan. And I would almost argue that due to the weakness of the political party system, the majority of people elected at this time are independents, that it's going to be very difficult for us to draw a lot of lessons about the Islamic Action Front's evolution, any of the political parties' evolution, until we get a little bit further down the road in the development of that system. Really, that's basically it. The report, I think, is very valuable to us in our work, because I can recall working in Indonesia just a few years back, and we were well underway, having worked for 2-3 years at that time with Islamic parties as well as with secular parties. And suddenly, USG policymakers came to us and said, are you actually working with party X? And we had been doing it for 2 years at that point. And there was great concern that we were working with this Islamic party, and the idea that this Islamic party would be that kind of a threat in a democratic election. So this fear, I know, is still out there in several circles here in Washington, and I think this report should go a long ways towards trying to assuage some of those concerns. So, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'd also like to start by thanking the United States Institute of Peace and Dan Brumberg in particular for providing such a valuable service to democracy promoters by sponsoring these series of reports. I also want to acknowledge the fine work done by Mona Yacoubian on today's paper, which I too found to be very illuminating and helpful. We are all aware, as Mona diplomatically points out in her paper, that discussing official U.S. government efforts of promoting democracy in the Middle East in general, and certainly working with Islamist organizations and political parties in particular, is a sensitive topic. And I'm very cognizant that I'm the only U.S. government employee up here on today's panel. But I'd like to carve out a fairly narrow niche for myself and really try to speak from the perspective of a foreign aid donor, and USAID in particular. Additionally, rather than focus on the three-country case studies, which have been discussed so ably by my colleagues at NDI and IRI, I wanted to focus on the end of Mona's paper, which has not been discussed too well much today. And she highlights what she calls three policy implications, but I think basically the recommendations to us on how we could do a better job. And I'll paraphrase those three recommendations as we, the U.S. government, needs to better understand Islamic actors and the institutional environment that they exist in and operate in. Second, we need to look for opportunities to engage with Islamists through institutional capacity building within governments, broadly defined. And third, we need to work to engage with a broader number of Islamic actors beyond just political parties outside of governments. On the face of it, those are three very common sense recommendations. And I think a fair question would be, what would a democracy promotion program that follows those recommendations look like? It so happens that there are two programs that exist outside of the Middle East that do essentially what Mona suggests. While it is dangerous to draw broad lessons from such a limited number of cases, the two are similar enough to each other, I think, to make an interesting paired comparison. USAID supports the Asia Foundation's Islam and Development programs in both Bangladesh and Indonesia, and has done so for quite some time. Both these programs began as general development programs, but did evolve in part to have an explicitly and overtly democracy and good governance focus. In Indonesia, the Asia Foundation is engaging with a wide range of Islamist actors, as Mona suggests. For example, they work with two mass-based Islamic civil society organizations, Muhammadiyah and the NU, to conduct what's essentially an ongoing, perhaps one of the largest voter education campaigns ever conducted. By the time the next presidential elections run around, it'll have been active for about 10 years, and will have fielded approximately 500,000 voter educators and also election monitors. In addition, this program works directly with the Pisantrians and the mosque to work with local religious leaders to help strengthen their capacity to engage directly with local governments on issues that are important to them and the community at large, to make local government both more effective but also more accountable and transparent. In addition, with USAID funding, the Asia Foundation also sponsors an Islamic weekly radio call-in show that deals with social and political topics evolving around democratization, access to justice, gender equality, human rights, elections. By some measures, it's the single most popular radio call-in show in all of Asia. The Bangladesh program is somewhat narrow in scope because it has a smaller budget. But it also has a democracy focus, particularly related to human rights and elections. And the primary partners that the Asia Foundation works with, again, are a broader range of Islamic organizations, as Mona suggests. Organizations such as the Imam Training Academy, the Islamic Foundation of Bangladesh, and the National Imam Association. Now, these programs, I'm not going to suggest that these are more successful programs than the three that were highlighted, because they're just very different. It's not fair to make that comparison. But it is accurate to say that they do represent a different type of engagement, a broader engagement with Islamic organizations, which was not the intent of the IRI or the NDI programs. Nonetheless, I think there are some lessons that could be learned and perhaps applied. First, I don't think it's a coincidence that these two programs fall geographically outside of the Middle East, nor do I think that it is a coincidence that they began before the Iraq War and, in fact, before September 11th. They also began not as explicitly democracy programs, but evolved into programs that are geared towards democracy promotion. Second, and this sort of gets technical, but you can never do a program like this, in my opinion, via a contract which binds our implementing partners very closely with the U.S. government. I think these sorts of activities really should be done through a grant, which is essentially the government giving a gift to an organization like NDI and IRI. I also think that the organization needs to have previously demonstrated its own legitimacy and bona fides in that country, rather than just sort of come in as a U.S. government implementer. While both of these programs had an explicit elections focus, as it corresponded to the election cycle in Bangladesh and Indonesia, they did not engage and have not engaged to date with candidate training or political party development. I think that work is critical and needs to continue, but I don't think that a program should encompass both types of activities, because I think that becoming overtly partisan makes it very difficult to build the broad coalitions that are necessary for these sorts of programs to succeed. While Bangladesh and Indonesia have very different political environments, neither of them has the same political Islam equals political opposition formula that exists by regime design in most of the Middle East. So I think it makes it easier to engage with broad range, visibly engage with Islamic actors, when doing so is not necessarily announcing that you're engaging with opponents of the regime. Finally, there needs to be local Islamic actors that are seen as legitimate, are willing to work with the United States government, and organizations the United States government is willing to work with. That sounds obvious, but it's a likely showstopper, unfortunately, in a lot of countries that we think about doing these efforts in. So given all that, can these sorts of programs be successful in the Middle East? And I guess the short answer is none of us really know for sure. But I think they could be attempted more often than they are now. Modified for local conditions, of course. For example, the Indonesia program has essentially for years paid for pamphlets that are handed out every Friday at mosques across the country. And in fact, I don't know if they still do, but at least a few years ago, the last time I saw them, they had the AID logo on the back. Now, that's not likely to happen in the Middle East anytime soon. But nonetheless, the U.S. government has, for quite some time, as both Mona and Dan refer to, partnered with universities throughout the region. We've also supported NGO coalitions that include both secular and Islamic organizations. and through some of our non-democracy programs dealing with gender, dealing with health care provision. We've worked with a lot of organizations that have included those with an Islamic bent. So these are logical starting points for a broader or more strategic, if you will, engagement with Islamists and Islamic organizations, if such a decision was made to do so. So we're not starting from ground zero. Such a hypothetical program, like their real Asian counterparts, would have to have a long-term impact, in my opinion, to have any chance of success. Addressing the key democracy problems in most Middle East countries, which is the lack of meaningful political competition, in a way that does not undermine broader U.S. security interests or be perceived by policymakers to undermine those interests, is a very delicate balancing act and one that we're still trying to perfect. But as Mona argues, any serious effort at assisting a participatory and legitimate democracy movement in these countries needs to include Islamic actors, and I would argue beyond just the Islamist political parties. Current NDI and IRI programs represent a very important start, and one that is having impact, as Mona demonstrates. I think with patience and creativity, though, more certainly can and should be done.
Thanks, Josh, for those extremely interesting and useful comments. I'm just going to throw in a couple of my perspectives on the panel and then open it up to discussion. I would like to invite our audience to come to the microphones and provide your comments. We'll take them individually. I saw my colleague Steve Heidemann signal me. Please, Steve and others, come up to the microphones. A couple of quick remarks about this very interesting presentations. On the question of Morocco, although I think the lessons of Morocco are more widely applicable as well, I think it's obvious to us that as long as the seat of real political power and authority are not parliaments, but regimes and the informal institutions through which they work, the perception of voters will be, and I think this came across very clearly, that the political system isn't really genuine, parties don't have real authority. If you look at the figures on Jordan, and the public opinion on Jordan, 3-4% of those polled take parties seriously. That's an extremely discouraging figure. It's far under 10%. And I think that's really critical. I mean, if we're going to ask people to vote, we're going to have to give them a reason to vote. And this is something that has to do with the policies of governments themselves, which are not easy to change, particularly in a context where we're focusing often on issues of security. In the case of Morocco, there's a related lesson here, and that is from the perspective of non-Islamist or secular parties, so long as they can turn to regimes for protection, so long as they believe that ultimately the real place of power is in the monarchy and its allies, they have no real incentive to get their act together. Certainly the competition from PJD in Morocco was one incentive, but when we were in Morocco for our conference, the striking thing from the perspective of the secular parties was, A, how afraid they are of moderate Islamic parties, in part because they are moderate and potentially successful, but B, how they believe that ultimately the way they can protect their interests is still through the king and his allies, and therefore there was very little evidence of any kind of alliance building in Morocco. Quite the contrary, when we had our conference, it was difficult to get the PJD and the secular parties together at the same table. And we're talking about representatives of PJD who are known moderates. So this is a real structural problem, an impediment in the system of Arab politics, and the extent to which the political field remains depoliticized is a striking contrast with a place like Indonesia. If you consider the experience of Muhammadiyah and NU in Indonesia, these are two mass movements which emerged under the rubric of an authoritarian regime and were able to mobilize members for years under that umbrella. So when you move from a quasi-authoritarian system to a democratic system, they were able to mobilize their members. There was a political life to Indonesia, and you don't find really an analogy in the Middle East on that level. And it's striking. We'd have to sort of, in some sense, address the basic nature of political life and the absence of a strong sort of political field. It's one thing to register opposition to the current system through apathy, non-voting, or spoiling ballots. It's quite another to feel that there's an option out there that you can actually vote for and engage in, and that it makes a difference. So I think there's a huge set of structural impediments, as you say, in political science to getting people to take these political systems much more seriously. But I think that the effort to build stronger political parties and to encourage alliances is certainly one way we're going to get the attention of these regimes. And with that, I'll take turn over the mic to my colleague, Steve Heidman. But please, I'm inviting anybody from the audience to come up to our mics. And we encourage succinct, short comments. I know we'll get it from Steve as opposed to longer speech making as time.
Well, I have about 30 minutes.
Go ahead, Steve. Help yourself. Take
no, you very much prefigured the question I wanted to pose, because this disenchantment with political parties raises one of the bigger questions surrounding this whole effort to encourage moderation among Islamists and to encourage participation by Islamists in electoral competition across the Arab world. And that is the unfortunate fact that elections do not seem to change the underlying distribution of political power in Arab states. And at a certain point, that forces Islamists to confront a very, it forces all political actors to confront a very difficult question, which is whether the payoffs from participation are worthwhile, understanding that electoral outcomes will not materially affect the distribution of political power. And what I'm very curious to hear about is whether in the work of NDI and IRI and AID and other democracy promoters in the region, these issues are part of your conversations with the groups with which you interact in the region, what their own views about this dilemma are, what they feel about this trade-off, and what kinds of conclusions they're drawing about the virtues of moderation or the limits of moderation as they move forward confronting regimes that hold elections which, as we saw in Morocco, are transparent, free, and fair, but do not alter the distribution of political power.
It's a great question. I think it's the foundation for another conference, Steve. But we'll get
if USIP were
possible. let's start with our panel, including Mona, and just work our way this way and provide some perspective on which is on the fundamental question here.
Right. Well, I will respond very briefly. I'm sure both Les and Tom, in their work directly with the parties, will have more to say. But I think it's a great question, Steve. I think the Moroccan elections really are a huge red flag as to where things are going. And no doubt, these parties are fighting battles, frankly, on two sides. They are certainly attempting to, I think, walk a very narrow path between being able to work with and reach out and engage with the West, but also maintain their credibility with the masses, if you will, with the street. And I think it's exceedingly difficult. I think the letter that Les pointed out that the PJD wrote about my report, essentially lauding the PJD as an example to be emulated, was taken very much as an insult, almost. And I think that speaks to the difficulties that these parties have. I think the elections in Morocco only underscore how deeply rooted the problem is, and that there are clearly extremist forces, as I point out in my paper, that represent another side of this battle, and the battle for the hearts and minds of people. And if there is no confidence in public institutions, it's very difficult to understand how it is that these parties are going to continue to vest themselves in the system in the long run. What I found to be so impressive was the capacity of Islamist parties to smell out openings and use them, legitimate political openings, and use them in very effective ways. But nonetheless, if you have essentially emasculated legislatures that are considered rubber stamps of the government, that's only going to get you so far. There's got to be a legitimate opening, hence one of the recommendations in my report, that efforts to work with Islamist parties and actors must necessarily be accompanied by real and genuine institution building so that they are working within a functioning democratic system.
I mean, I think this is the essential question, Steve, that we all have to face. And that what has happened in the cases of Yemen with ISLA, I think it's starting to happen to the PJD. It certainly happened to Al-Wefaq in Bahrain, which probably kind of fits into this category as well, is that as these parties have participated, I think in good faith, have anticipated that when they did participate that some sort of power would accrue to them, they have faced situations where the parliaments have not become significantly stronger, where governments have resisted any kind of power sharing or devolving power as a result of elections. In the cases of ISLA and El Wefaq in Bahrain, clearly the more radical figures within the parties are being strengthened, or groups outside of these parties are being strengthened. So in Bahrain, El Wefaq is having, you know, its heels are being nipped at by the radical Shia groups. In Yemen, there was just a news clip yesterday about the moderates within ISLA coming under increasing pressure and attack from the radicals, who are not seeing any progress in ISLA's kind of cooperation. And I think the PJD will probably see this as well, because the outcome was not really what they expected, and now they may not even participate. They were starting to toy with participating in government. So the fact that elections take place, that they take place quite well, but power doesn't change, is a huge, I think, is a huge problem. My last comment on that, though, because this would be the topic of a whole other discussion, is that in the cases of Morocco and Jordan, there is just about zero motivation for the U.S. government itself to push for the kind of institutional change that we think needs, probably most of us here would need to think needs to happen to allow these Islamist parties to participate more meaningfully. And I won't go too far into that, but I'll tell you, just without getting too detailed, that in Morocco, there was very little receptivity on the part of the U.S. diplomats to an analysis of the election that said this was a resounding message to the king. That was not how they saw it, and they didn't want to see it that way. And in Jordan, we, as the elections are approaching in Jordan, our relationships, NDI's relationships with the embassy and with the diplomats, are starting to very quickly fray, because the government itself is starting to get nervous about the outcome. So there is no motivation for the U.S. government to push in Jordan and Morocco for the kind of institutional changes that are necessary, i.e. constitutional change that turn these places into genuine constitutional monarchies. No motivation. In Bahrain, there's very little motivation, and in Yemen, there's not much motivation either. So that this is a huge, speaking of structural impediments, that's the structural impediment.
These are very young parties still, and they're working in transitional systems, and I think they do see this as a very long-term thing. So I don't think they're going to get disillusioned that quickly. A lot of times when we're talking to political parties in these cases, these types of parties, about not only elections but governance, and you talk about the things, the proactive things they should be doing once they do get into office, and they say, well, we don't do that here, that doesn't work. Invariably over time, they find that by assuming these roles once they're in office, that they do affect some small changes. In a report, Mona points out that the types of parties we're looking at today are characterized by having very strong ties to the community. And I do think they see this as one aspect of a multi-layered approach to life and society. So I would expect to see them here in 10 years, 15 and 20 years, still plugging away and making change and making incremental progress.
Josh. Well, Josh, you want to fill us in on the USG perspective?
No.
I thought you might say that.
I mean, I don't disagree with Les's characterization. I think, again, I'm going to try to cleave very closely to my niche here as a working as a donor on behalf of the U.S. government, as opposed to speaking broadly on U.S. policy. But I think, I mean, it's clear just an objective look at the political systems in these countries points out that there's a glass ceiling on meaningful political party participation if the measurement yardstick you're looking for is that they're going to become electoral, if not liberal, democracies where the people really have the true ability to select the leadership of the country and change the leadership if they so desire. You know, I think when you sort of retroactively look after periods of rapid democratic change, either sort of progress, which we would hope, or failure or crisis, you could sort of see what ingredients were there, even if you can't predict exactly when they're going to happen. And I mean, clearly many of the ingredients are still lacking in these three countries. And as Les pointed out, you know, there's not necessarily a lot of external pressure that's likely to be put on anytime soon. So I think I'm sure the parties are just as aware of that as anyone else, that it's not within their own power to fix the situation they're in.
Yes, sir.
Sure. Andrew Ng, Carnegie Endowment. I was actually in Morocco last summer around when doing field work on U.S. democracy promotion around when this boycott was announced, this PJD boycott of cooperation around the outbreak of the Lebanese war. And I know you talked about it in your report as one of the limitations of engagement. And I found, and I think what I've been informed of more lately, is that it's an ongoing boycott. There have been, as Tom mentioned, contacts and a dialogue, but it's my feeling that this does heavily circumscribe what kind of engagement and cooperation could happen with the PJD in Morocco, and I was hoping that I could hear more about what really is the potential for further engagement given this boycott and the limitations it imposes.
Yeah. Just briefly, and I'll let Les and Tom also address this more in more detail, but it's my sense that the boycott clearly was very much about protest over the Israel-Lebanon war, but that it continued in part because of the impending parliamentary elections that just took place, and that it was a very astute political calculation by the PJD to attempt, again, to play to its audience. It speaks to precisely what we were talking about in the previous question, about this need to bring along the base to maintain credibility. The fact of the matter is America's image in the Middle East is, you know, I would say at an all-time low. And so these parties are going to play a role. I was still impressed, I will say, that even with ongoing boycotts, and not just in Morocco, in Jordan as well, there was continuing, and I think, and again, Les and Tom can speak to this in greater detail, but it is my understanding that there continues to be discussions, meetings, people talk to one another, and frankly, that in and of itself is important. Perhaps with the election now over, I imagine the PJD is very much in postmortem phase, trying to figure out what to do next. And with the 2009 municipal elections looming a bit over the far horizon, my sense is that engagement will be reinvigorated with the party institutes.
This sounds like a simple topic, but it's a complicated topic. And I would say a couple quick things to address it. One is that in places like Morocco and Jordan, it appears that the regime itself, you know, le pouvoir, whatever that might mean in Morocco, you know, the whole structure around the palace, and in Jordan, this also the more the interior ministry and some of the intelligence services like to jack up this whole question. In other words, sometimes the parties PJD, IF, and Jordan feel compelled to make public statements about their relationship or lack thereof with U.S. organizations because they feel that they can be attacked by sort of status quo forces. It's not necessarily as much playing to their own crowd as trying to immunize themselves against attacks by kind of government-oriented forces, number one. So it's a little complicated. But on the other hand, sometimes they like to play politics, and I know that with our staff in Morocco, they're all former politicians, former minister, former elected members. Whenever the PJD sort of launches a small broadside against NDI, which they do occasionally, their newspapers print, you know, kind of nasty articles, no one working for NDI Morocco worries about it because they say, it's true, it sounds trite, but they said, wow, a political party playing politics. You know, what a shock. And we don't really worry about it. And frankly, they continue to participate and cooperate with us in areas that they think are advantageous for them, including parliamentary work. So it's, you know, like water off a duck. We just don't worry about it.
It really is the same with us. I think it just requires, you just have to keep in mind what the purpose of the work is, and it's not there to gain kudos for U.S. democracy promotion, but it's actually there to work with a whole range of political parties. The poll that Les referred to in Morocco last year that caused PJD such headaches was simply a poll that just showed them at that time doing well. And as in a lot of countries, including this one, nobody likes to be the front runner at times because everyone turns their fire upon you, and that's what happened to them. And it put them in a very uncomfortable position, and it actually led to us not doing any more polls, which probably would have shown some of these changes coming for them, and it might have allowed them to tack a accordingly on platforms and other things. The Moroccan parliament even considered legislation to ban polling in the country as a result of it. So it just requires you to understand that while people are in the streets denouncing the United States, they may this weekend be in the seminar, and that's what we just keep focused on.
You know, the head of Muhammadiyah in Indonesia, there's a PhD from UCLA who rose to the head of Muhammadiyah with an anti-American campaign, but styled with American politics in mind. And he's continued this this very strident sort of anti-Americanism, which also has even worse aspects to it when we look at it. Yet, I don't see any evidence that they've refused to work with the Asia Foundation or take funds from the United States. So it is very much a political game. Radwan, yes.
My name is Radwan Masmoudi with the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I want to start by thanking Muna and Dan and USIP for this event and for the report. I think there is a very dangerous trend in the U.S. in the last couple of years of lumping all Islamists together and seeing them as enemies of the United States, as almost as terrorists, as synonymous with terrorists. We see this a lot in the media, and I'm really, really worried about where it's taking us, because I think that not only it will kill prospects for democracy in the Arab and Muslim world, it will also kill chances of succeeding in the war on terrorism, because we're lumping a very, very broad sector of the society and of the Muslim world as basically terrorists and enemies of the United States. So this is really a welcome counterpoint or counter trend to that, I think, what I see as very dangerous trend in the U.S. Three very quick questions. I think it's obviously extremely important to reach out to these moderate Islamist parties, but I think we need to do a lot more than that. I mean, one thing that I think we need to do is reach out not only to these small parties, and they are still rather small in Jordan and in Morocco, but to the political parties that have not yet been recognized by their own governments as political parties. For example, Al-Adl wal-Ihsan in Morocco is a very popular party, but has not been recognized as a political party. I think we need to engage with them also in a dialogue and see how they can become part of the political process, because that will lend more credibility. My own guess is that in Morocco it's Al-Adl wal-Ihsan boycott or call to boycott the elections that really played a big role in the low turnout in the vote. So I think we cannot only reach out to these smaller parties that have been recognized by the governments, we have to reach out to all the other parties, as long as, of course, they reject violence and terrorism. Number two, I think a very important effort or part of the effort is to build these coalitions between Islamists, moderate Islamists, and secularists. I mean, it's one thing to meet with them and you know, talk and discuss things, but it's much more important to build coalitions where they can, together, moderate Islamists and seculars, agree on a certain platform for democracy and start to challenge the status quo in a much more, you know, forceful way. So I think, I don't know if you've been doing that, I'd like to hear more about that. At the center, we've been really working hard to establish a network of Democrats in the Arab world, and also we have a program on democracy education in the Arab world where seculars and Islamists developed the textbook together and used the textbook together to train people on Islam and democracy. So they had to agree on, you know, almost word by word on what to put in these textbooks. So that's my second suggestion. The third suggestion is really, what are we going to do right here in Washington, D.C., where we don't see this, you know, we're almost going back to the pre-9/11 policy of supporting, you know, oppressive regimes. I mean, our talk of promoting democracy has almost become a joke in the Arab world. You know, we're in bed with Musharraf, we're in bed with Mubarak, we're in bed with all the tyrants. I mean, even in Tunisia now, Congress delegations are going almost on a weekly basis, you know, to Tunisia and saying great things about Ben Ali and the government that we have in Tunisia. So what are we going to do here in Washington to make sure that we don't slip back to that policy of supporting or coddling dictators? Thank you.
Three great questions. Who wants to start? I suggest that anybody wants to sort of tackle one of those questions, that would probably be the best thing to do, because there's, again, an agenda there that's it far exceeds what we can do today, this morning. Mona.
Can I just very brief comments. Thank you, Radwan. I agree with everything you said. I think one thing I think is to just underscore the heterogeneity of these Islamist parties, not only from one party to the next, but within the parties. And this is something that I try to flesh out a bit more in the report. But the fact is that the parties themselves are very fluid and very, there are factions and so forth, and I think it's essential, and that was one of the intents of the paper, is hopefully to try and, to some extent, demystify for the policy world in Washington exactly what these parties are like. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe that will go some way toward addressing your final point about U.S. policy toward these. Again, from my perspective, working with these Islamist parties is completely consonant with our broader goals, our national security goals and our goals regarding democracy promotion in the region. And so I would hope that we can have more of a dialogue and discussion about that in the coming months and years. One other point, and then I'll let my colleagues discuss it as well. I think this notion of secular Islamist coalitions is hugely important. I was very, very impressed with NDI's work in Yemen, had the occasion in our conference in Morocco to meet with members from both the ISLA and the Yemeni Socialist Party who were there together. And frankly, even their personal relationship was a testament to the capacity of people from very different ideological backgrounds to come together in the cause of reform. I believe strongly that it is that those types of coalitions are essential, and in that sense, Morocco is a model. And they really have been able to accomplish, frankly, quite a lot in a very, very difficult situation. They have a lot more work to do, but I do think it's a model that ideally NDI and others will be working on for other countries in the region.
Maybe really briefly, I'd love to talk about what to do in Washington, but it's, but I think I also agree with your characterization of what's going on. One anecdote about Morocco, which was interesting, is you're right. I mean, there were certainly powerful forces calling for a boycott. One of the things that we sort of laughed about in a sad way was that there was an umbrella group that was part of the local domestic monitoring coalition, you know, the national domestic monitoring coalition, a group that claimed to represent 500 civil society organizations that were domestic monitors. They were also calling for a boycott of the vote. And we laughed because we had never actually run into domestic election monitors calling for people to boycott the vote. But that was more a reflection of some kind of mixed up rivalries within the civil society groups. But the building of coalitions, I think, is an important point. It's something that we do work on a lot. It is very important. It's difficult. I think Dan mentioned, I think it was Dan that said that it was difficult to get the secular Moroccan actors to sit with the Islamists in a conference in Morocco. We found the same thing. But we have always, when we've had a chance, for example, the NEDS World Movement for Democracy meeting in Turkey last time, where NDI put together a panel with on Islamist parties, we invited representatives of the Moroccan USFP and others. And I think some of you were there. It caused a big blow-up in the panel because they couldn't stand each other. So it's, you know, it's something that we try to work on, but it is difficult. It's a long-term, it really is a long-term affair. But I think it is extremely important, as in Yemen, to get these parties to realize that they have common cause when it comes to political and civil liberties, that is where they have common cause, and to get them to work together on opening up the political system.
I think in a lot of the training that we do in the region, we bring several political parties together in one room. And in 12 years with IRI, I can't tell you the number of times in every region of the world, parties say the only time we sit together is when IRI or NDI is in town. And although they're there in the same city daily with one another, they just don't meet on topics of political issues unless... And so over time, you can see in other places where we've worked longer than we've worked in the Middle East at IRI, you know, that does produce electoral coalitions or coalitions in parliament and so forth. As far as working with non-registered parties or non-legal parties, for the most part, IRI works with a very broad range of political parties, but it has to have some kind of criteria which also allows us to be in the country. And usually the host government doesn't want us working with non-registered parties. There's usually a very broad range of legally registered parties. And so that's pretty much how we have to focus. But very often it's either the host government or the donor does not want you working with just any political grouping out there. Within the legally registered parties, there's usually a broad range which accomplishes the goal.
Yeah, I think I'll speak on your second point and as it relates to your first point. I think it's certainly the perceptions out there, but I think it's not wholly accurate to say that U.S. policy is increasingly vilifying all Islamist political parties or painting them with a negative brushstroke. But I think it is accurate to say that U.S. government policy when dealing with Islamist political parties is fairly risk adverse. And I think that leads to the sorts of conversations that Les referred to with, say, the U.S. Embassy in Amman, Jordan. I don't think there's any sort of nefariousness out there, but it's a very risk adverse culture that U.S. policy is in right now vis-a-vis this topic. But I think that highlights the importance of building the sorts of coalitions that you talked about, because I think if you were going to outline a ideal process of political change in these types of countries, that would have an outcome that was both beneficial for the country itself, but also from a U.S. security policy wouldn't cause great worry and consternation. It would be a transition that was the result of a broad-based coalition between secular organizations and Islamic organizations. We've tried to do those things a lot. I think collectively, and not just U.S. donors or U.S. implementers, but more broadly, I don't think we've quite perfected it yet for the reasons that Les and Tom talked about. But you're absolutely right. I think it's vital. It's central importance to what we do.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Mark Perry, Complex Forum. I wonder if U.S. policy really is that risk averse. There was a Islamic party that won an election in the Middle East in January 2006. Hamas won the parliamentary elections. And the U.S. policy was to boycott Hamas and to ask other Arab nations to join that boycott in Europe, which they did. And I wonder what the effect of the Hamas boycott was on other Islamic parties, and whether that boycott actually seeded resentment against the United States among Islamist parties, and whether closing off the hope among Islamists for the use of democratic levers of change actually seeded the message of al-Qaeda and other extremists, which was, don't believe the United States. They'll never accept a democratic outcome, even if you win.
Who wants to tackle this non-controversial subject?
I'd be happier to answer that question, not on business hours,
frankly.
I think it's a valid, the United States could have taken a very sort of revolutionary position after the PLC elections last January. They chose not to, and I think you could argue from both sides that was either, had benefits or had a cost. It's a compelling question, but I don't really know. You can't prove a negative in terms of what would have happened if we had engaged more proactively or welcomingly with Hamas. So I guess, again, I'd be happier to answer that after business hours.
Interestingly enough, in the case of Hamas, we didn't demand, as some of us believe we should, that Hamas disarm before an election. Mm-hmm. We, on the one hand, refused to deal with it. On the other hand, we essentially gave our blessing to an election in which the one party was really a militia.
Yes.
And we know the outcome of that sort of policy in Iraq. So I think that it's a very complex subject, the Palestinian one. And the other observation that I would offer about the Palestinian elections is that Hamas's so-called victory was more a consequence of the fragmentation of Fatah than any necessary correlation between their power and public opinion. And if we take a hard look at that, we'll see that there could have been a very different, or certainly a different outcome had Fatah not been split, and had the electoral system itself not worked with that condition to facilitate a Hamas victory. So some of the obvious conclusions that have been drawn from the Hamas victory by American policymakers pro and con democracy promotion, as well as players in the region, are not that obvious or accurate.
Right.
Anyway, yes, ma'am.
I'm Miriam Amarsadeghi, and I wanted to go back to the point about showstoppers. Josh Kaufman, you mentioned, and if I understand correctly, I wonder if NDIIRI and Mona, if you also believe that there are showstopper countries, countries where this type of engagement or democracy promotion is not possible or worthwhile or is too risky. And Mona Yacoubian, I wanted to go back to what you mentioned as indicators of success and how your methodology was set up. The first indicator was about content of platforms and what it is that these Islamist parties and groups are saying in their websites and communications. I wonder if you can go into a little bit of how you distinguished between sort of good content and bad content. What were some of the points that distinguished between moderate and radical Islamists? Thanks.
Sure. Why don't I take your last question first? It's a great question, and again, let me be very honest. This was by no means sort of a scientific study, and the whole question of good versus bad, moderate versus extreme, as you know, is subjective. From my perspective, it was really more looking at, I guess, a couple of things. One was the priority of issues in a platform. In other words, the extent to which issues that have to do more with governance, accountability, provision of social services to people, very sort of classic, if you will, political party staples of a political party's platform, the extent to which those kinds of issues took precedence over what I term sort of moral agenda issues, insistence on applying Sharia law to the fullest extent, such that women must be covered and segregation of sexes and so forth. The other was just listening to the public statements and sort of looking at the public statements of the PJD in particular. I think they're the most noteworthy in this regard, where there are some who are even questioning whether it's still an Islamist party in the truest sense of the word, where they now talk about themselves as being a party of Islamic reference. So they're informed by the values of Islam, but they are not insistent, for example, on the implementation of Sharia law. They use it as an overall inspiration. So that was really what I meant. But in all fairness, it truly is preliminary, and perhaps much more could be done in a more scientific and empirical way as to looking at specific content and how it's changed over time. And I think I'll turn it over to the others then for the other questions.
Well, maybe on the on the showstopper question, perhaps I can refer back to the Hamas question. When looking at the Arab Middle East and thinking about the Islamist parties, I see Hamas and Hezbollah as somewhat different, and it is hard to lump them in. They often are lumped in the popular discourse. And in the primary campaigns right now, you take a campaign like Giuliani's, which obviously has some real hardliners associated with it, and you get, you know, the specter of the violent Islamofascists, they call them, and so on. And of course, you have to disaggregate. But I tend to see Hezbollah and Hamas as different in the sense that there is still this tremendous complication of the question of militias, the question of renouncing violence. I realize that's a very loaded and complicated question. But the stated intention of Hamas and Hezbollah to continue to resist, whatever that might mean when they say it, it means different things when they say it anyway in different contexts. But so I'm just going to put those aside because it's a difficult topic and difficult to address right now. But of the political forces in the Arab Middle East that have the potential to participate peacefully, I think the big kind of remaining question is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, because it does appear on the surface to be willing to participate much as the PJD or ISLA or Al-Wefaq participates. It does appear, hard to say because there are many different leaders, but it does appear to be a group that that does not will not pursue violence in the way that that people are worried about, and it does appear to be a group that if given the chance, would likely register a party or some kind of a political branch. And yet, it seems to be more or less off limits. Not quite off limits, but when the U.S. ambassador to Egypt met with Muslim Brotherhood members of parliament, he received quite a bit of flack in some quarters for doing so. So that to me is a very open and very important question. And I suspect that under the right circumstances, NDI certainly, I'm not sure about IRI, but probably we'd feel the same way, would be glad to engage with the Muslim Brotherhood as a legal participant in the Egyptian political process.
Yeah, I really don't know of any other, each country on a country-by-country basis, an approach, but I don't really know of any other showstoppers, as you had mentioned. So much of it, again, is driven by donors and the funding source, which requires various things of you and has you explicitly state you won't work with particular groups. So,
Oliver Wilcox, I want to recognize Oliver's presence here. Oliver is our other colleague from USAID, and he was with us in our conference in Rabat. So, Oliver, please.
One comment, one question. The comment is implicit in what the panel has talked about in terms of change or progress in terms of political reform. That's pretty substantial, pretty almost seismic shifts in terms of Arab political systems. And I would encourage us, at least as democracy promoters, and NDI and IRI do this all the time in their work, to look smaller. And probably the broader people who don't implement but have an interest in this topic need to look smaller as well. So when Mona, for example, talks about institution building or capacity building, let's not look for parliaments, for example, to start rejecting budgets that are submitted by the executive. Those tend to be the benchmarks that even we as democracy promoters put out there for ourselves. And it's a bit of a straw man because we're not going to get there, generally speaking, in the near term. So things like, to make it a little more concrete, oversight responsibilities by committees in parliament. And this is some of the work, for example, that NDI is doing in Yemen. That's frankly the level that we need to be, and in some cases we are looking at, but I don't see the general sort of democracy promotion discourse reflecting and giving credit to the small steps that need to be taken. So we need to set our sights more realistically. The question is with respect to Jordan, and Jordan is obviously the case of least engagement compared with Morocco and Yemen for a variety of reasons, some of them which have been mentioned here today. But what are less in Tom's sense of what the prospects are for engagement? Neither of you, for example, mentioned the last-minute pullout of the IAF from the municipal elections and their allegations of steps taken by the government to basically marginalize their candidates. And I'm not commenting on the validity of those claims or not, but just pointing that out as a wrinkle, and the fact that there are internal discussions in the IAF about whether or not they're even going to participate, whether they may boycott the parliamentary elections. So your sort of quick take on what the prospects are for your engagement in Jordan in the future based on those developments.
Well, just on the well, first of all, Oliver, I mean, I agree that that setting the sights a little bit lower and more specific is very important. And there have been a number of success stories in this way. You know, strengthening committees, how political parties behave in certain situations. You know, when we looked at platform development, policy development, opening it up to more. To more public input, constituency relations, and you can measure these things. You can see that you know, members of parliament organize meetings in their home constituencies and so on. And I think that looking at all those things is important, which gives me a chance to say something which I haven't had too much chance to say lately, which is the people that do look very broadly at these things, sort of the pundits in the newspapers and to some extent academics looking at these things and with a very critical eye, have been very quick lately to pronounce the entire Middle East democracy policy as a failure. And it's often tied to President Bush's name, obviously. I really do not see that at all. I think that we had a difficult time last year, and certainly speaking for NDI, we had a few bad moments. Our representative was more or less deported from Bahrain. Our visas were denied for Algeria. Egypt, they were trying to, you know, kick IRI out. We let them take the brunt there, and we tried to stay in the background, but we were in the same position in Egypt. And so it wasn't a lot of fun. But, you know, after a year has passed, it's not so terrible. We're still more or less engaged in all those voices. We're back in Bahrain doing almost what we were doing before. Everything's sort of patched up. Algeria is still a problem, but we can deal with it. Egypt, we're both still surviving. IRI is very busy doing things. We're trying to catch up a little bit. Not a big deal, but when you kind of step back and look at accomplishments, if you think of this, the democracy in the Middle East, as it's only been a serious endeavor for 6 or 7 years tops, but probably really for five or six years, if we're 5 or 6 years into a 20 or 25 year policy with all sorts of different entry points, it's actually going along quite nicely, I think, quite nicely. And I think it's very, very premature and kind of very wrong, I think analytically wrong, to start pronounce it all dead. No, it's not at all. You can point at many, many different pieces of success. One of the important ones being that Islamist parties, like the ones that Mona looked at in this paper, have been demystified, and they're participating, and they're participating kind of normally and getting kind of normal results. They're not dominating, they're not doing poorly, they're doing well, but it's not the end of the world. So I think that's a big success. Jordan, just really quickly, big problems in Jordan. The IAF is starting to engage with NDI. They got criticized for meeting with us in government newspapers. But the what happened yesterday was that the Jordanian government has now said that they will not accredit any domestic election observers in Jordan, which is a real step backward. If it's true, it would be one of the few countries left in the Middle East, one of the few kind of relatively open countries that doesn't do that. So there is some real backsliding going on in Jordan right now. And our take on the IAF pulling out of the municipal election was that they were not going to do as well as they anticipated, and they didn't want to show their cards prior to the parliamentary election, which was more important to them. But that's a subjective analysis.
When we were doing exit polling in Jordan during municipal elections, at around 11 o'clock that day, the exit polls were showing a substantial decrease for IAF chances. And so we didn't release it that day when they said they were pulling out because they were being abused. But it would appear, and that fits in with 15 months of polling in advance of that, that was a steady decline in IAF support. And as I mentioned earlier, and an increase in Arab nationalists and Jordanian nationalist tendency in voting. So I believe they have since had to take up the question of IRI polling because it undercuts this idea that they pulled out over ballot integrity reasons. I would also just say they did not participate in IRI training activities or opportunities before the municipal election. Now individual members of IAF are coming to us for parliamentary candidate training. That sort of fits in with something else in Mona's report, and that is, these parties are, interestingly enough, the most internally democratic parties often in that country's system. And you do find that that wouldn't occur in another political party. They would have such a rigid top-down control. Anyone who appeared at something like this without the party sanction would be out. So it sort of illustrates it in a funny way, what she's saying about these parties.
I think to get at what Oliver's saying about small targets and incremental progress, and to build on what Les was saying about a long term, I think it's important that if we transported ourselves back prior to September 11, the late 90s, a lot of the same conversation about whether the complexities of our policy, whether or not we were being hypocrites, these sorts of conversations were going on then. And they were going on a smaller number of countries. So I think in some respects, that's a demonstration of progress, that we're engaged more broadly now than we were, say, in 2000. And the lightning rod then was, like one of the lightning rods now, obviously, was Egypt. And the AID program, the democracy program, was essentially a whipping post for people that wanted to talk about how hypocrisy. And I'm not going to say whether or not there is hypocrisy. That's, but nonetheless, it got to the point where in 2000 and early 2001, I was suggesting that we should stop bureaucratically calling the Egypt program a democracy program, that I just thought it was complicating things. And I was not a huge fan of the program, but the folks that were implementing it in our mission, particularly a very large commercial law program that they were calling democracy, and their point, and this is getting at the incremental progress, was we recognize that improving commercial law administration in Egypt is not going to move the bar much on democracy in a regime with no real political competition, gross human rights violations. But their sense was that, first of all, the judges they're training, the way the judicial system works in Egypt, are also working on criminal cases, and that their plan was to essentially move into courts of first instance and criminal courts. Now, I have to admit I was a little dubious, but sure enough, that's what they've been doing. Under the radar screen, not touted as a huge democracy success because it's in a environment where there has not been much progress, and certainly the progress that we had hoped for seems to have stalled. But nonetheless, there are now U.S. government-funded legal experts that are working on criminal law issues in Egypt, that to the point where there's a real chance for criminal law code reform, there will be essentially a vehicle to do that. If they really want to improve access to justice, if you know, if they want to do security sector reform, well, you can't just, from a donor perspective, do those things overnight. And it's the incremental progress in some of these countries that is not visible and not measurable, and will make a difference in the future.
Let's take our last two questions, make them brief, please, and we'll wrap up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Maslowski with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, and thank you to the panelists for their insightful comments thus far. I have a fairly basic question, which is essentially, why is it that we are focusing on whether or not Islamist parties have moderated, as opposed to looking at whether or not non-Islamist or secularist parties have moderated? It seems to me that asking the question that way stems from the assumption that Islamist parties start out in a more extreme position, and yet if we look at the benchmarks that Mona outlined for us, three of the four, internal party dynamics, how transparent and democratic they are, how active these parties are when they actually are in parliament, and the fourth was, I guess, how willing these party members are to go across ideological boundaries. Using those three of the four, it seems to me that non-Islamist parties would fail and therefore be less moderate, just as much, if not more, than these Islamist parties. So I'm curious, aside from the fact that obviously it's a sexy topic and policymakers want to hear about Islamist parties, it seems if we're genuinely interested in moderation, why are we focusing on these parties that seem to be doing fairly good in that regard? Thank you.
That's a great question. I mean, I think, to be honest, the intent of the report was to, as I said earlier, to demystify. And unfortunately, I take everything that you've said, but I think that the conventional wisdom is quite the opposite. The conventional wisdom is that Islamist parties, by their very nature, are anti-democratic. And so it was important to understand, A, again, as I noted in my initial remarks, the very fact that we are engaging with these parties is in and of itself noteworthy and important. And it's, to my mind, it's sort of one of the secret success stories, if you will, of U.S. engagement in the Middle East, and one that's not talked about a lot. And I think the fact that it's not talked about a lot is indicative of the controversy, right or wrong, that surrounds it. And so the intent of this was to look at it with as much of an objective point of view as possible and to try and understand better what are these parties like, how have they responded. I absolutely agree. I mean, the secular parties, and this is the other problem in the Middle East, secular parties by and large are dominated by aging leaderships, have very little connection to the grassroots. As Tom points out, their level of transparency within the parties is negligible in many cases. Their rhetoric often is as anti-American, anti-Semitic as any. So it's a fair point, but I think that the intent of this was really to try and understand better and to demystify what it is that's going on with Islamist parties.
And Mona, if I may just very briefly amplify on that in the context of the wider goals of this project, of which Mona is an important key part, we're really interested in the gamut of organizations, secular and Islamist, that are interest that do interest representation in many respects. And one of the things that comes across in all our studies is that secular groups, precisely because they feel they can't compete with Islamist political parties, tend to depend on NGOs and other non-political entities to sort of do their lobbying for them. And in the case of Morocco, that's a pretty effective policy in some respects. They get certain kinds of results. And I think you find an echo of that elsewhere. And so long as they perceive, and you can say this is a moderate or not moderate perspective, I think the moderation issue is in some sense a distraction. For these groups, as long as they perceive the outcome of an election as one in which they get not only politically excluded, but potentially culturally excluded, or ideologically excluded, they are not going to want to change the status quo. Middle East regimes, Arab regimes in particular, are very good at playing the political liberalization game. They've been doing this for years. We walked into this situation, unequipped analytically and strategically to deal with that simple fact. But players on the ground understood it and understood what they were getting out of the status quo as it was. And I don't see an indication, even from secular parties that are more democratic. I mean, the YSP has been around for quite a while. They have a new generation of leaders. Those are the leaders that have pushed for this alliance with the Islamists in Yemen. But they don't actually, in many respects, run the political party yet. And yet they are very wary about many aspects of this alliance with the Islah. Because the issue is not merely whether Islamist parties do or do not support violence. The parties we're talking about do not. But whether in the long term they have a cultural agenda, which is radically different. It's almost an existential issue. I mean, there are political issues, but there are basic issues. And these are extremely difficult to negotiate and produce a platform. You can talk about procedural issues. That's one thing. We can agree on procedures. But when you're talking about is Morocco going to speak French or Arabic? And our colleague from the Socialist Party who came to our conference in Rabat, his perspective was, we speak French, we're part of Europe. We're part of this world, not that world, and however moderate these other guys are, I can't come to some sort of basic understanding with them, because the issue here is basically the question of national identity and where it sits. So these are challenging. You can say, well, you know, refusing to deal with them is an example of not being moderate or extremism. Perhaps you can judge it that way, but I would say that that's a distraction as opposed to understanding the basic motivations that that make it difficult for these two groups to cooperate more and more effectively.
I think that the questions and answers contained in Mona's research have their greatest value at a policy level. But for the party institutes, we don't approach Islamic parties separately or in a different way than we approach secular parties. They all sit together in the same room. They receive the same training materials. They receive the same presentation. So, but I do think the paper today we're dealing with probably has its greater implications for people here in Washington at the policy levels rather than we practitioners in the field.
Final question.
Yeah. I'm Steve McNerney with a project on Middle East democracy. I want to return largely to Morocco and the PJD and ask a little bit about impressions on the reason for their performance being, you know, so far short of their own expectations and most observers' expectations. And I feel like most analysis that I've seen after elections is focused more on the low turnout across the board, but if it was really across the board, then it wouldn't have affected this balance so much. And along with that, any indications of the PJD's own perceptions of the reasons for their underperformance? And is there a risk that you know, some of the measurable forms of moderation that Mona talked about in her paper may be, you know, seen as causes for their electoral failures. And is there a risk of now of a backlash and them kind of seeing that this various forms of moderation, both in terms of content and their methods of participation, have failed, and that they were, you know, touted as having sort of improved get out the vote programs and et cetera. And if they didn't yield results, where on the other hand, you know, kind of region-wide, the places where Islamist parties have had success at the ballot box are not the places that we've been engaging them, not the places where you've seen the moderation, but, you know, you could say that Hezbollah and Hamas and the Shia parties in Iraq have had more electoral success, and is there a risk that the parties that you've looked at that have, you know, we have engaged and it has resulted in measurable moderation, but not in their expected success at the ballot box? Is there sort of a risk of them perceiving that and changing course?
I'll just take a very brief stab. It's a great question. My sense is that this is still very much early days with respect to what the answer is. But I take your point. Clearly, the PJD boycott or no did not do as well as it would have been anticipated. The one thought that certainly came to my mind as I saw those results was that, and I think it was suggested earlier, maybe by Radwan, that Al-Adl wal-Ihsan, which was calling for a boycott, not directly, but that their perspective on the elections with respect to those who would typically vote for an Islamist party won the day. In other words, that those that may have come out and voted for the PJD instead opted to stay home, and that resulted in their not doing as well. I think behind all of this is not so much the question of becoming too moderate, but one of the issues that has always been a chink, if you will, in the PJD's armor is the sense that it is too close to the palace, that it is part and parcel of the system. And indeed, it talks about working within the system. It's something that all of us, I think, seek to encourage. However, there are perils with that, in that is it essentially a completely co-opted party, whereas Al-Adl has been very distinct and has maintained a tremendous separation from the palace. Indeed, it does, you know, calls for a complete overhaul of the system. It doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the king as the commander of the faithful and so forth. So just very quick, that would be my one sense, is that we might have to start looking a little bit more closely at Al-Adl and what they did or didn't do in this and what role they may have played in the PJD's not doing as well.
Just a couple of quick points on that. One is that, well, it's important to remember the PJD was number one in the popular vote in Morocco, so they did pretty well. I mean, they were the number one party. They had the second largest number of seats, but in the national list, there was a national list in Morocco that was exclusively for women, but it was where people put a mark for one nationalist, not localist. The PJD's percentage of those votes was 13.4%. And the next party down got 11.8%. So they did significantly better than most parties. So it was not a failure, but I think they started to believe their own press to some extent. I think that their bragging of winning between 70 and 80 seats was largely conjecture, not backed up by reality. And like any political party that got cocky, they maybe didn't put enough effort into getting out the vote. They didn't perhaps take it seriously enough in the end. But I just want to mention something about public opinion research. Tom has mentioned IRI polls, and IRI has done polls in Morocco up until they were discouraged from doing that, and in Jordan and in Palestine and so on. NDI has, and Mona mentioned this, run a focus group center in Morocco for a number of years now. We also have a focus group center in Jordan and in Lebanon. And these are some of the only centers in the Arab world that run genuine independent political public opinion research, and IRI is one of the few organizations that consistently fields genuine political polls. And I can tell you that, and I've been the director for Middle East programs in the NDI since 1996, there has never been evidence in any Middle Eastern country that I know of where NDI and IRI have been doing public opinion research that Islamist parties were going to sweep elections or that they had support that was going to dominate everyone. That's kind of it's sort of a thing that's a figment of people's imagination, and it comes, I think, from the overheated policy debate in Washington. There's just never been any sign of that, and even Hamas in Palestine, IRA has been doing polling for 10 years. They were stuck and have been stuck for many, many years in the 20% range. You know, they'd creep up to 30%, they'd go back down. And as Dan mentioned, yes, they did very, very well in the PLC election, and that probably was the zenith of their popularity, but the election system and other things conspired to amplify the victory. It was actually a fairly close split. And since the election, it's a complicated question, but since the election, their level of support has dropped down again. So I've been saying this for as long as I can remember, but it's so hard to prove, but I still think it's the case, is that there is absolutely no evidence that parties with an Islamic reference or Islamist or whatever we want to call them have a core support of, say, greater than in the 20% range in any of these countries. They simply don't. People are, they have a multiplicity of views, and given the right opportunity, the Islamist parties will do well, but there's not any great evidence that they should dominate. And so when they don't dominate, in a sense, we shouldn't be all that surprised.
What about Algeria?
Algeria? Well, like the early 90s example.
Yeah. They did sweep.
They did sweep there.
That is an option on the cup.
Yeah, although the reason I didn't mention that is it's prior to my time, and also we didn't have... But that was kind of prior to the whole debate about democracy and democracy promotion. It may have informed a lot of that, and that may be what has caused the Washington debate
Absolutely.
To become so overheated. But it's one thing in time.
Could I, just quickly, since you mentioned, the roots of this paper lie precisely in the experience of Algeria and our response to it.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for a wonderful discussion. I want to conclude on this note, and that is responding to what Radwan said. I mean, I think it's important that we continue to have these sort of meetings and keep the democracy agenda on the front burner, as it were, as opposed to just quietly retiring. And everybody who was here today helped in that cause. I thank you very much.
I assume my comments this morning, is that appropriate for tonight?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm thinking about the overheated debate, even though they're not, our board members are not likely to subscribe to that. They're still affected by it. You know, the story is, like, I mean, I sometimes get questions, even from my wallet or from others. Lynn, so she probably got it from this too. I did get it from, what's her name, the girl who was crazy. We get this constant question, why aren't we, more strongly supporting the liberals, whoever the hell those people are?
Muna, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It was wonderful, really wonderful, really wonderful. And, I hope that we'll get them translated into Arabic, because this should be given. And you know, USIP
does translate reports into Arabic. We'll look at it.
And we come on the outside.
Don't put it in Arabic as a vice versa. It will cause any problems.
No.
Give you a card. I have to confess, I really work logic from home. I just have a little few people here, but we could either be here or we could meet somewhere else for a meeting, or coffee or whatever. Thanks for your question. It was a great question. That sounds good. Thank you.
Discussion group on Edward Nichols. I wanted to invite you, Peter Roman, I'm sorry I didn't bring the card because I was on it 69.
No, I just had this suit thing and I took the card, so it should have just lost it in the aisle.
Thanks for your comments.
Thanks for your comments. I usually encourage that it just kind of strike me.
I like the website, is this indiana.org?
Yeah, it's fairly, the Morocco statement, for example, is on there. It's actually a pretty extensive website. So.
Yeah. It's been very significant. This aside, we lived in Spain a long time ago. We had some bad news for them.
They were part of the Mediterranean, part of the Southern European world, or part of the Arab world. As Dan said, I think that's the essential question. Which direction do you look? Do you look west, do you look east, do you look south? And in Morocco, there's a normal debate among people who perceive themselves as Western Europeans who want to join the modern world. And then others, I mean, and the way that they would characterize it is that there are others who are backward and who are backward looking and are looking east and not like it. And I don't know if that's just almost a secular or it's whatever. It's just, you know, people, it's like, from here, we all know different points of view. We seek out like minded people. I don't know if you can define it, but you kind of know people. And so you end up with these two groups, and then one calls itself, you know, one's got a quote Islamic reference, the other one's secular, but they may be just as religious, frankly. It's more a matter of just a worldview.
Hey, Ron, how are you? So you're still surviving. I get these desperate emails. We're sinking. We're under the water. $25
now. And he couldn't just become secular. He became Christian. The faith vacuum had to be filled. He could not just leave Islam and just become like a rational humanist or like a Jack Mormon or sort of unactive.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Last Catholic or something.
You can be a devout Roman Catholic and still get all sorts of respect. But yeah, you can be an army.
It's almost like in Scotland, the word for a man without a clan, the Gaelic word meant broken man.
The Spanish. It's hard to break out of that. That's why secular, we just use it for shorthand here, obviously. It's kind of meaningless.
There are a million European salts altogether in Algeria. There is a big Spanish. Everybody around this table probably already agrees. Can we hear this? Yeah. Can we hear this? Yeah. That's right. And this is, you know, I want to take over a little bit.